What's up, bootlickers? I haven't seen y'all since camp out. I got something to say, right?
Anarchy! Anarchy! I don't even know what that means, but I love it!
Anarchy is, and always has been, the best way and the only morally sensible way to run the world.
Cool. It's not just cool. It's the intersection of life and politics. Activism and action.
There's only one way to get power. Organize. All the workers together. One big union. And the war the IWW wants you to get into is class war. War against the capitalists.
Come on. It's not criminal to be an individual.
It's not criminal to be an individual.
How could you go to a riot without me? You were supposed to be my riot buddy.
I'm escaping. One place that hasn't been corrupted by capitalism. Space!
I was a victim too. At least my wife was. She had friends who were socialists.
Oh my god.
All right. Welcome to this live edition of the Three Life Show here at noon, February 22nd, here at Grand Street Community Arts, WCAALP, The Voice. I'm Dan Platt, Platt with a two A's, here at the Three Left Show, your leftist reading hours. This week, three lefts are socialism, ecology, and anarchism. It's been a while since I've done an episode on that third, anarchism. I'm going to do that today. I'm going to talk anarchism. What is it? What forms does it take? How do we move to a post-capitalist present and future? That is the broad question of this show. And I will be exploring that this episode, as I do every episode, in various ways, because we are all have multi-tendency lives and minds, and we should not be stuck down in dogma and inflexibility of sorts. This show covers news, culture, and anything of interest from a radical left perspective, though not particularly a news show, because the news cycle and following it every week on the basis on a regular does lead to some type of insanity. Talk about direct democracy, direct governance, direct economics, community economics particularly. I always have a jumble of thoughts going on in my head all the time of what to talk about, various screeds, rants, dialogues to have. Some are more prompted when I have a guest in the studio. When I have Julian on, I'll talk Democratic primary stuff and the usual establishment rigmarole like usual. But usually when I discuss kind of deeper topics and more of an exploration of things you may not know about, since I do not take that cynical ploy that people are dumb and unchangeable and it's human nature to be asshats, I take that usually is not stupidity or something like that, but more of an ignorance of alternatives, because we are not taught alternatives from the get-go. It's something that we have to put time into, and most of us don't have that time and luxury. It does take a bit of privilege, and I've had that. So I've tried to digest a decade's worth of reading and being an intellectual nerd, a political sci nerd of sorts, try to digest that into a few hour audio that you can listen to at work or when you're doing any kind of drudgery or repetitive task or what have you, like I did for a number of years, where I digested many, many hundreds, thousand hours of podcasts of various types to discover how to understand the world and change it, as Marx would say, not just to understand it, but to change it. As I kind of took that, you know, get your own house in order kind of advice, but not to that logical, that illogical conclusion that you can never be perfect, so why change, why fight for any kind of better world? I would say, well, I at least want to understand the world to the fullest, or at least to the point where I'm confident that I have a grasp of reality and what is going on. And that's what I did during my college years. That's why I'm kind of defender of college, and everyone should have some kind of tri-terry education, usually a term not used, but it's important to think of it that way, because trade school can be a type of tri-terry education as well, but it should include something broader too. But usually, when I do this kind of deep topic episode, I usually just at least start by tying it, trying to start with something that is happening in this week's news cycle, primarily the last Democratic primary debate, the one that has Bloomberg. That's the subtitle, the one with Bloomberg. Why is Bloomberg terrible? Primarily, whatever, like, say you like gun control, you're for gun control, he puts money in the gun control causes, or at least has purported to put money into gun control, which, again, you got to show me the results, right? The results matter, not just how much money you put into it. For example, here in Albany, a Bloomberg philanthropic project put in $1 million into an art project that was, well, sold as spoken dialogue about abandoned buildings. Now, it was a nice project, and the money was used to rehab and stabilize about a dozen or so properties. But otherwise, you got to, like, what are the tangible results instead of just selling the intangible, especially if you're going to talk about money and stats and how efficient you are. But anyway, it's how Bloomberg basically has been able to curry the favor of half of the country's mayors. But anyway, I'm getting off topic. Point I'm making is, despite whether you think he has done great things, and I myself can admit as far as bike lanes, but the means do matter, and he is very authoritarian. He is an authoritarian liberal, let's say, but he is authoritarian. And why is authoritarianism bad? You know, because otherwise, on the face of it, if you're middle moderate American, it's fine. It's fine to be a little authoritarian as long as things are stable, right? Then we get into a longer, drawn-out conversation mentally that, you know, Bloomberg is desirable as long, you know, because you want a manager of the country. And you want the country to be well-managed if you are doing fine, right? If you benefit from the status quo. That amount number of people is shrinking by the day. And or there are people who think they benefit from the status quo when, let's say, if you're in the bottom half of America that are poor or on the edge of being poor, then you should realize that Bloomberg's authoritarian liberalism would not benefit you at all, just as his philanthropy benefits very few people. And assuming, like, he's going to take that kind of tact and just seed grant the entire country, like that's going to be his policies, it will not, right? He's running to keep his taxes low to defeat Bernie Sanders. At least that's the analytical way of looking at what is going on. So I'm starting with, you know, to set up that our politics are, on the most part, authoritarian, right? Whether it be left or right in the mainstream sense, the establishment, Democrats, establishment, Republicans, they're authoritarian. And of course, the populist right also has all of its authoritarian tendencies, even fascist. Like the one that I, you know, the ICE director that I demoed against this week at the local sheriff's office, the only sheriff in New York apparently working with ICE. So I start with a article from Nathan Robinson, editor of Current Affairs. I click with Nathan Robinson because, like myself, kind of a multi-tendency leftist, he doesn't go hard against, like, other types of leftisms or, like, ways of organizing. He tries to be a big tent leftist, like myself, trying to work with multiple circles, not be dogmatic. And here's an example of that. His article, his little editorial, is called The Power of Anarchist Analysis. So not being an anarchist per se, because the word is scary or it evokes images that have been put in your mind by our media, just like how, like, if you think of Pitbull, you either think Mr. Worldwide or Fighting Dog or Dog of Poor People that are mean and dangerous from the hood, you know, those kind of racist images. And an anarchist is, you know, someone breaks windows, starts fires. Well, you know, some do that, yes, but not all the time. And it's not primarily what anarchism is. So even if, say, like, I'm not going to identify as an anarchist no matter what, which, granted, but there's a power of anarchist analysis. That's the title. Let's go into it. How anti-authoritarian thinking makes the world clearer, meaning helps you understand the world and what's going on in it a little better, because without the lens of authoritarian versus anti-authoritarian or libertarian, you just think in terms of left or right as a political spectrum, nothing makes sense. I don't know how you make sense of it. I tried to when I was like 18, and I couldn't make sense of it. Because otherwise you just get stuck thinking that left and right or the political spectrum is more government spending versus less government spending. Completely ignoring all their questions like what is the money being spent on, how it's being spent, so on and so on. And all the other questions of government, society, and free will. So let's get going and going. Question everything. Like the bumper sticker. Have you ever seen that bumper sticker? I've seen that bumper sticker around. Question everything. I have a button that says question everything. I always liked that phrase. I might have claimed to be among those who did indeed question everything. Also, another thing about Nathan Robinson, he isn't too dissimilar from me in terms of stature, wears glasses, nerdy demeanor, nerdy white guy, so on and so on. But if I'm being honest, for a long time, it was more like a coffee mug cliche. It didn't mean very much. I didn't actually question everything. At most, I questioned a thing or two here and there. I have begun, however, to question more things, and I strongly recommend it. In fact, if you do, and if you really do it, some rather remarkable things might be on the horizon. The world would be a better place if we all spent a little more time using an anarchist analysis. I first fell in love with anarchism, with capital A, when I took a college class called Red Flags, Black Flags, Marxism versus Anarchism. I couldn't, when I began it, have told you anything about it. To the extent I understood it, it just seemed a kind of mindless rejection of all government. The usual image. The class, however, introduced me to a way of debate, an intra-left dispute between anarchists and Marxists. It is a debate that changed the way I think about everything. First, the existence anarchistic socialists instantly showed the idea that socialism as state control, like more government spending, could not be true. So side note about the rhetoric in the Democratic primary debate, you know, with Bernie Sanders, democratic socialism, all of that policy falls under this or the umbrella of social democracy, which is that we still have capitalism as an economic system, but we have more government spending to offset the harms of that system. So to me, it's not system change, and it isn't socialism. So any kind of red baiting, meaning like Bernie Sanders, he's a communist, it's over, he's unelectable. Now, I'm going to also back up and say, that's what was said about Obama. You know, America, meaning white men, won't elect a black man, so Obama is unelectable, and it's over, he shouldn't win the primary. Same argument, same. It is a debate that changed the way I think about everything. So in fact, economic socialism, which was about popular or is about popular worker common control, and whenever or not that is done through the means of a state, was a hot source of contention, which is the debate between Marxists and anarchists, which is socialism best done through public control via state, centralized or decentralized? And here in America, we like to think we like decentralized control. That's why there's this usual revulsion, what Reagan was elected on, of, you know, state bureaucrats and bureaucracy and big corporations, just big anything. Keep it small, decentralized, right. I liked anarchists more, or most, because they asked penetrating and useful questions and refused to defer to authority. They warned that unless socialists had a strong commitment to liberty, as they did to equality, supposedly socialistic regimes might end up oppressing the people in the name of freeing them. Mikhail Bakunin, famous anarchist, warned that socialism without liberty is slavery and brutality. And when the people are being beaten with a stick, they are not much happier if it is called the people's stick. Proudhon, another anarchist from the 1850s, in a letter to Karl Marx himself, offered a precedent caution against left intellectuals seeing themselves as an infallible proponent of a new dogma. Let us seek together, if you wish, the laws of society, the manner in which these laws are realized, the process by which we shall succeed in discovering them. But for God's sake, after having demolished all the primori dogmatisms, do not let us turn our dream of indoctrinating people. Do not let us fall into contradiction of your compatriot Martin Luther, who, because Marx was a German. Do not let us fall into the contradiction of Martin Luther, who, having overthrown a Catholic theology, at once set about with excommunication and anathema the foundation of the Protestant one. Let us carry on a good and loyal polemic, meaning good faith arguments. Let us give the world an example of learned and far-sighted tolerance. But let us not, merely because we are at the head of a movement, make ourselves the leaders of a new intolerance. Let us not pose as the impossible apostles of a new religion, even if it be the religion of logic, one of reason. Let us gather together and encourage all protests. Let us brand all exclusiveness, all mysticism. Let us never regard a question as exhausted. When we have used our last argument, let us begin again, if need be, with eloquence and irony. On that condition, I will gladly enter your association. Otherwise, no. Proudhon is a Frenchman, by the way. It was a warning that many of those who flew the red flag ought to have listened more closely to these criticisms. Anarchists could be quarrelsome and even impractical. A famous anarchist slogan is, in fact, demand the impossible. But they were also wonderfully clear-sighted. An anarchist never conspired in a delusion that a clearly oppressive society was, in fact, a place of freedom. There is a wonderful scene in a film, Dr. Zhivago, I've watched about half of it in an English class, where Klaus Kinski has a cameo as an anarchist imprisoned on a train carrying forced laborers. So Dr. Zhivago takes place during the events of the Russian Revolution. Kinski's anarchist declares himself the only free man on the train, because he's the only one willing to call the guard a lickspittle and a liar to his face after the guard claims Kinski is there as a volunteer laborer. Oh, maybe I should play the clip. Anyway, it's in the article. You can watch it. When I hear the writings of, or when I read them, Kropotkin, Berkman, Matelza, and Emma Goldman, I was impressed by their force and clarity. Goldman, in her writings, My Disillusionment in Russia, wrote frankly and honestly about how her hopes about freedom to be found in the Soviet Union, which was recently founded, had been dashed during her visit. I'd come to Russia possessed by the hope that I should find a newborn country, with its people wholly concentrated to the great, the very difficult task of a revolutionary reconstruction. Now, of course, new societies are not built quickly. And I had fervently hoped that I might become an active part in the inspiring work. I found reality in Russia grotesque, totally unlike the great ideal that was born the crest of high hope in the land of promise. I saw before me a big Bolshevik state, formidable, crushing. Every constructive revolutionary effort is more suppressing, debasing, and disintegrating everything. Importantly, though, Goldman's disillusionment did not lead her to become some conservative anti-communist. She remained revolutionary socialist through and through, because she had a vision of socialism that was both anti-capitalist and anti-authoritarian. I often think that anarchism's slogan should actually be, actually, both of those things are bad, because its commitment to rejecting false dichotomies and declining to join one camp over another. My appreciation of anarchism was deepened by my reading of Chomsky, who identifies himself as operating within the anarchist tradition. Although, a little aside, most of his political advice seems to be vote blue no matter who. Even saying in an email from a question that because Bloomberg accepts climate change is happening, that he would be a better president than Trump. I think that is a distinction without a difference. Considering that what he did in New York to address climate change was sort of progressive as far as getting the ball rolling on some projects, woefully inadequate to the task, especially since he was quite the strong man as mayor and authoritarian. What he did with his power for the most part was install large bike lanes and pedestrianized areas, which was helpful, but not exactly citywide, no citywide regulations, let's say, to actually stop the installation of new gas boilers and oil boilers, you know, the dependence on fossil fuels and so on. That is not going to happen in any kind of moderate presidency, because managing the system as it is the purpose of what of his presidency, or any presidency rather. So if it's not President's Day today, consider this anti-President's Day. Many anarchists are skeptical of whether Chomsky is an anarchist because he endorses plenty of social dem policies. He thought you should vote for Hillary Clinton if you lived in a swing state, and which is not very revolutionary. Oh, and is not himself, really. His political approach is highly pragmatic, although I have issue with calling a non-revolutionary approach pragmatic, considering we are looking at climate catastrophe in this space. That's why, to me, any kind of moderate president, or even Bernie Sanders as president, is not actually realistically addressing our problems. His intellectual approach, however, is thoroughly anarchistic, intellectually speaking. So he often speaks about the anarchist approach to the legitimacy of authority. Quoting Chomsky, authority, unless justified, is inherently illegitimate, and that the burden of proof is on those in authority. If this burden can't be met, then the authority is in question and should be dismantled. Now, this is generally the better definition of anarchism, which is not against all authority, all governance, but that governance and authority that can't be justified. Now, depending on the person, their bar might be really high, and it would be really hard to justify any authority or any governance. I think there's a, again, in my view, pragmatism then comes in the form of having a sensible standard or explainable standard of what's legitimate, or a standard that doesn't outright disregard or ignore any governance, any authority, any kind of collective action. Because there are the people who preach collective action, some anarchists, but they're pretty bad at doing it because they don't acknowledge any collective governance. They don't think it's justifiable. Now, that doesn't mean there are no legitimate authorities, but it does mean that no authority is presumptively legitimate. A king's orders might be good ones, but they may not be good because he is a king. You know, Bloomberg gives a lot of money out, but that's good, quote unquote, but that doesn't mean that what he's doing and the decisions he makes are then good. Your professor might be right, but they are not right because they are your professor. Simple. Interestingly, Chomsky's anarchistic approach is one way in which his twin intellectual endeavors, those of language and political critique, are unified. Chomsky has always brushed aside the common question, what connects your linguistic work with your analysis of U.S. foreign policy? By correctly pointing out that there is almost nothing in common between these things. However, one way in which these two parts of his life are united is that in each domain, he achieved his insights through applying an anarchistic presumption against existing authority. His influential critique of behaviorist explanations for the development of language and his precipitation of a revolution in linguistics came from a willingness to ask simple questions that challenged conventional wisdom, like a true trendsetter. Likewise, Chomsky's writings on U.S. foreign policy frequently focus on how powerful actors use euphemisms to cover up their atrocities. He does not accept justifications for war because they come from foreign policy think tanks, or because they have elite credentials and a binder in front of them labeled evidence. He points to simple questions that do not receive satisfactory answers. For example, why was the Vietnam War not being classified as a U.S. invasion of Vietnam, even though that's what it plainly was? Why is an act committed by the United States never labeled terrorism, even when it is identical to an act committed by one of our enemies? In discussing how to study human beings, Chomsky famously invoked the example of a Martian visiting Earth. The Martian would be something of an anarchist, in that they would not have any reason to accept any of our justifications for things until we satisfied their questions. I think this is some of that satisfying humor that comes from these web comics where it's like two aliens talking to each other, and they're just doing normal, everyday human things, and the humor comes from them kind of talking like robots, and far as like they're giving a gift, and it's like, oh my. Anyway, I can't really quite replicate it from memory, but because it's like it's getting under the assumptions of like our everyday actions, and there's a little tickles are a little. The Martian might notice things about us that we do not notice about ourselves, like seeing a unified human language structure rather than a set of many different languages. The Martian might be puzzled when you tried to explain what a nation-state was and why it mattered, or why we use chromosomal sex as an important category for classifying us. Or why do we have cars? This kind of defamiliarization, meaning, you know, so it's not familiar anymore, pretend it's like a new thing, trying to see things we take for granted as if you are seeing them for the first time. It is very powerful, generating creative insights. My friend Albert Kim says he has a much better understanding of politics whenever he tries to imagine our own society as if he was a teenager reading about it in a history book thousands of years in the future. How does, for example, the greater attention paid to Trump and Ukraine over climate change look to students 2 millennia from now? The anarchist has a brain that won't shut up. They cannot keep themselves from asking, what is this? What is that for? Must things be this way? Can they be different? Children, of course, ask questions like these, and one reason I like anarchists is that they refuse to stop asking these questions that we all had as children and never received satisfactory answers to. If you asked, why are some people very rich and other people very poor, and why do the rich people not just give the poor people enough money, you were probably fed some bull that doesn't really make sense. Some of us just stop asking questions, eventually, but anarchists are uncommonly stubborn people who do not accommodate themselves to society around them, no matter how intense the pressure. This is where an anarchist is usually made, like myself. I was bullied in elementary school. I had a good support structure at home, so it didn't lead to any kind of depression or mental traumas too much. Maybe in my social life, you can judge for yourself. But I was bullied, and authority figures, teachers, administration, did very, very little. In fact, they were unhelpful. The kind of unhelpful that occurs when you're harassed, abused, emotionally, let's say, not physically. So there's no fighting occurring, but you're being emotionally abused for weeks on end, and you decide to confront your bully and punch him in the face or, tackle him. Just ground tackle, just full body tackle. You will be the one punished. Even after, the weeks of abuse, because, hey, nobody saw it or no one's reporting it. And thus, it didn't happen. And so all that is seen is your action. I found that extremely unfair. And it showed me, or rather told me, that authority figures don't know what they're doing. If they did, they'd be able to prevent harassment, me from being bullied. But they can't. They seem to have no power whatsoever. Thus, why should I pretend they have power over me? But then, then I start, what power do they have over me? Okay, grading, my ability to advance the next grade, go to school the next year, blah, blah, blah. All that, success, stay in the success track, as it were. That's what they hold over me. And then I question, okay, why do I need to be in the success track? Why do I need this good professional job? Why do I need to make X amount of money to be able to live comfortably? Big questions that capitalists do not have good answers for, except, oh, it's just fair this way. You should, we all work and we all have to contribute to society. So they use societal arguments, but some people just have to work harder than others. And my work is more important and I should be compensated for millions of dollars, billions, in fact, if you're Bloomberg. Meanwhile, the person working 3 jobs, 70-hour weeks, they're working just as hard, but their labor isn't they're not doing the work. If they put in the right effort, then they could be making the right gumption and have the great winning out of the box idea. They too can be a millionaire. Or if they just exploited people like I do, kind of thing, where the unfairness is that everybody does not have the moral absurdities to follow through with being a successful capitalist. Let's see. Chomsky speaks of the willingness to remain puzzled and to keep asking simple questions. This can make them difficult, but it also means that they are like George Bernard Shaw's unreasonable man. The reasonable man adapts themselves to the world, while the unreasonable one waits for the world to adapt itself to them. That can mean that anarchism becomes a selfish and individualistic creed, of course, and that strain is always run through the tradition. But it doesn't have to, and we can accommodate ourselves practically to reality while refusing to change our ultimate beliefs. An example of that is the anarchist lawyer. A lawyer often has to make arguments they do not really believe. For example, in one case, they will argue that instead of looking at the letter of the law, that we should look at the intent of a lawmaker, because the intent of the lawmaker is more favorable to their position. Then in the next case, they will argue that we must look at the letter of the law and not its intent, because that is more favorable to the next client. Or you might have to accept premises that you don't really buy. If you are an immigration lawyer, you might have to say that your client's status is protected under X part of statute so-and-so, and thus they should stay in the country, even though really you couldn't give a fig about the authority of the statute, and actually all you care about is justice, and you'd still think that ought to stay, even if the state statute said the exact opposite. This is how most of us actually operate when it comes to the law. So acting as it's some objective standard of right and wrong is really quite ridiculous. So as a matter of political reality, considering just how often laws are and regulations are ignored, even when people complain about them. So as a matter of practical reality, sometimes we have to defer to authority. In an academic paper, someone might find themselves writing, Robinson, 2016, in his classic paper said that, and they might not cite Robinson because they believe Robinson was insightful, but because they know that the scholarly literature finds that Robinson was very important and the professor will expect them to cite Robinson. It is essential, though, that we try to resist doing this and constantly try to decide for ourselves whether we think Robinson was right or wrong. Now, in my college papers, I cited what was interesting to me. Didn't really matter who was writing it. I just picked books, not at random, but books that looked interesting, and then I read what was interesting in them, and then I cited the interesting bits relevant to the question that the essay was asking. So here's a few examples of a radical positions that the anarchist intellectual approach has brought me to. So number one, democratic workplaces. Finally, maybe getting into the public lexicon, thanks to Sanders campaign and other public intellectuals that are kind of getting more attention. But when it comes to socialism, at least halfway there, democratic workplaces, you know, brings up questions that I'll maybe address in the next hour. Yeah, I definitely will, actually. Where you could have a worker-owned and managed workplace, right? But a workplace, a business, still needs to be funded. Where does the funding come from? So there's another aspect of, like, whether or not something is really socialist or not, you know, because you could have a co-op, but if a capitalist bank put up the original loan for it and the co-op has to pay a capitalist bank, they're going to take on capitalist modes of production even though it's worker-owned and managed. Their management of the workers will still have a bias that will be incentivized to, well, exploit themselves or exploit their customers. Someone has to be exploited in order for profit to be made, pretty much. Why do you get to vote for your congressperson, but not who your boss is at work? Why can Amazon workers not vote to throw Jeff Bezos out of office if they think he's doing a bad job? The principle of democracy is that people should have a say in the decisions that affect their lives. But workplaces are intensely undemocratic places. As Elizabeth Anderson points out, linked to who she is in the article, politically, they follow the structure of dictatorships. The people at the top tell the people what to do, but cannot be removed by the people at the bottom. We accept the top-down structure as natural in the institution of the corporation when we do not accept it in the institution of government. Although that's becoming more and more acceptable because it seems like many liberals just like, oh, Bloomberg, he's going to get it done. That's his slogan. He's going to get it done. How does he build consensus? That's not his case. It's just that he knows how to get it done. It doesn't matter how. And that's exactly why it's being hand-waved, because his way of getting things done is his way, being the dictator. Another position then is open borders. Borders between countries do not make sense. They did not exist for most of human history. The idea that because you sprang into existence in one place, you wouldn't be allowed to go to another place is pretty absurd. Each person should have an equal right to move freely around the world. As a practical matter, it may be very difficult to unilaterally open one's borders, but it is very clear that a borderless world is not only possible but necessary to keep our future world, as well as our present, from being absurd and irrational. I mean, when you look at the deaths that occurs, people try to move between borders, that is absurd, irrational, and horrific. We know it, or at least, you know, if you're or a rather xenophobic right-winger, then it's like, oh, it's terrible that children are dying at the border. Yeah, exactly. Militaries and nuclear weapons in themselves. The institution of a military might be bizarre from the perspective of our Martian. It is a rather from, like, if you look at the our military from new eyes, as, you know, don't take it for granted that we have to defend ourselves from enemies, meaning really our economic rivals, though. So it is a colossal waste of human resources that exists only because humans have not found a way, or good ways, of cooperating that do not involve threatening each other with death. Once again, unilateral disarmament might not be feasible, and pretty much isn't, but putting uniforms on people and have them prepared to be ready to murder each other at any moment is an idea that humans should someday be laughing about as they look back over a bloody prehistory of civilization. Kind of a Star Trek future. Civilization being a thing that we might achieve someday in the future once we learn what that would actually entail. Here's another position. Bureaucracy. Bureaucracies often survive because they are accepted. An anarchist asks, how much does this paperwork is truly necessary? Is it really necessary for this regulation to be 100 pages long? Anarchist economist David Graeber wrote a book that I own called The Utopia of Rules. His main case is that bureaucracy, promise of bureaucracy is that it makes things more fair. It equalizes the distribution of public services, let's say. The reality is it reinforces existing inequalities. So it's a myth that more rules means more fairness. If we really want fairness, it's not done with top-down regulations. You need to actually look at the entire structure of society, the modes of how things are made and owned, and that's exactly what leftism does. Property itself. Private property is a particular construct. What does it consist of? What does it mean for a thing to be mine? Now, in terms of law, it means that I have the right to exclude other people from using it by force, and that if they attempt to do certain things to it, I can stop them. Proudhon pointed out that the origin of these rights are very mysterious. If we start out with the world owned by all, how do people develop the right to carve off bits of it and exclude others from using them? So this goes back to actually answer that question. It's done with organized violence. It starts with armies and it ends with armies. Which is to say that property rights can exist with the threat of violence and organized violence. So if you think that's immoral, or not okay, or something that we may not need forever, or shouldn't need it forever, then property should be more flexible, or should be more like everyone should own something or part of something. And that the only thing that should really be rentable, or that you can morally justify being rentable, is a room in a house, right? But not in the Airbnb hotel kind of way, but actually renting to a person with a lease contract. Because anarchists don't particularly reject contracts, because what is a contract but a mutually consented upon agreement that doesn't need an overarching authority, though of course an authority is used to enforce a contract, but having a contract as a written agreement that could, say, be enforced by community social pressure, let's say, but just generally it means that the agreement has actually been accepted by both sides. Religious authority. I do not mean to disparage all religion or religious beliefs here, but for the most powerful revolutions in human thought have come from those willing to question religious authority, declining to accept the explanations offered to them by clergy. Today, many children in the U.S. still grow up in fervently Christian communities that tell them obvious lies about the world, but it is difficult to be a dissident against your parents, pastor, and friends. This is why the growth of non-religiosity, atheism, the being none, no religion, has really kind of exploded, if not grown, or just those identifying as such have grown, because the internet has allowed people in isolated or kind of homogeneous communities to actually reach others of who have the same questions, doubts, and thoughts. So that's a positive about the internet that I'll always kind of go back to, is that it does in fact connect people who are either, like, you know, otherwise you'd be isolated in a community where everyone is at least purported to think the same. But there's also, on the flip side, a scientism. In correctly rejecting the absolute authority of religious texts and asserting a belief in the independence of mind, some atheists themselves forget the importance of questioning. people like Sam Harris, another man I actually own a book of his, for instance, speak in the name of a thing they call reason, capital R, reason. But because they are not anarchistic enough, because they do not scrutinize those who profess a love for science with the same intensity that they scrutinize the religious, they end up being very unreasonable themselves in the name of reason and practicing scientism, a thing that looks like science and uses its rhetoric rather than actual science. Because they ignore soft sciences and are quite authoritarian in their outlook. And then there's the law. I majored in political philosophy, says Robinson. I did so in part because I was fascinated by a simple question, like, why should people obey our laws? It turns out that many of the simple answers to questions like this do not really hold up under scrutiny, believe it or not. Take the Constitution. It is not a democratically legitimate document. The majority of the country, women, black people, native people, were excluded from participating in its drafting and ratification. It fails the tests that we would use to determine whether a law has moral authority. And yet we ask people to respect it. And the Supreme Court overturns democratically legitimate laws, you know, the ones that are passed more recently, that are inconsistent with this democratically illegitimate one, meaning the Constitution. Now, the answer to this is simply having a new constitutional convention where we draft a new constitution. And I'm not talking about the Bill of Rights. That's separate. When we think about the Constitution, we're talking, you know, usually the first is the Bill of Rights. But historical footnote is that the Bill of Rights was tacked onto the Constitution by those that basically said, this Constitution is like only drawn up by, you know, us rich white landowners. Maybe, and it doesn't really protect anyone who isn't us. So maybe we should, you know, there are people who actually had, you know, the interests of the common man or were from places where common people had pressure on them to say, we need to be able to protect the press and the things that we know are needed for a free society or for your, relatively speaking. So I think we need a new constitution to kind of reformat our government. Instead of just these piecemeal reforms that are proposed to fix the partisanship extremes of our time, like me, make sure I don't have any political weight or something like that. The thing that comes to mind is like a new constitution probably allow states to actually secede or break themselves up, balkanize, as we call it, and create like new political forms. Instead, the reforms are like, we need to break up the bigger states with the bigger populations that are blue states, so they have more, there are more blue senators. This is a stopgap, and like, it doesn't get traction for a reason. Gender and racial hierarchy. Feminism is born from the rational thinking, from refusing to defer to social tradition and prejudice and demanding answers for why things are the way they are. People like Ben Shapiro are not anarchists. They accept simplistic conceptions of what gender is and do not interrogate them or try to formulate better or more sensible concepts. Likewise, with racism, Shapiro and other reactionary rightists does not pause to ask himself why he finds black names funny. Because he does, apparently. And Charles Murray does not scrutinize his own preference for European culture. Charles Murray is the writer of The Bell Curve, which was genetic environmental study they did, basically said black people are genetically inferior, they're just not as smart, but he has biases and he won't admit to them. Both science and the study of history are enriched by feminism and anti-racism, which correct for the bias that come from certain perspectives and voices being excluded from any analysis and therefore leading to falsehoods being accepted as truth. This is the case with most of the history of science. That's why the social sciences and postmodernism is a positive development, because it brought in, let's include other perspectives so we're less biased. So that there is less bias, because it's not just us, white men, doing it. Views on animals. Many of us engage in a glaring act of moral inconsistency. If someone mutilated a live dog in front of us, we would consider that person a sociopath. Yeah, we accept the mass industrialized killing of intelligent creatures for food as somehow not being sociopathic. Once you start to think about it, really think about it, and realize just how much harm is inflicted on and will keep being inflicted on creatures other than ourselves who cannot speak, cannot vote, and do not own property, it becomes clear that animal welfare has to be at the forefront of our moral priorities. And I've made the case in other episodes about how animal rights movement is integrated with human rights. And that the strategy of saying, like, you know, we deserve human rights because we are not animals has not been particularly effective. Because in dehumanizing a certain type of other creatures, it actually allows for the more of the mindset to dehumanize anyone who is different enough. And then it depends on what your standard is for what's different enough. Let's see, how many more? Oh, this is so much longer. So I'm gonna. So he has a. He lists a lot more things. I'm gonna go for the funny one. Aliens. Okay, this is the fun one. But why is it that people don't believe more about aliens? Why do people who believe in aliens seem weird? The universe is unfathomably gigantic. To believe we are the only intelligent life in it requires thinking that we are the most special thing that has ever lived. I think it is far more likely that we are not special enough for aliens to think we're visiting. And this has been quite sad. But there is plenty of intelligent life in the universe, but the realities of physics mean it is impossible for many of them to find each other. So that's what's more unreasonable. And the podatist, which is kind of a joke political tendency, is that the aliens that are advanced enough to have space travel and get to us will be the actual socialist civilization that will liberate us. It's a joke, more or less. Anarchism is very powerful as an analytical tool, but less so as a guide for action. So here's where we get into, in the last few minutes of this hour, kind of like why he isn't a full anarchist. And also kind of why neither am I. But let's see how much I agree with him. This will be a rereading for me. So we have discovered that major arguments for private property are fallacious, or we discover that militaries are the absurd result of a failure to solve what should be a basic problem of cooperation. We have looked around us and demanded that the world justify itself. The world has shrugged and answered, "I guess I can't." The economist Joan Robinson, similar last name, reported that after she pointed out that an important part of neoclassical economic theory was incoherent, other economists admitted she was right, but simply continued as if she hadn't proven what she had proven, because it was not clear how they could do otherwise. If in political cases the Supreme Court decides based on their political values, as we all do, rendering their stated reasoning specious and their opinions worthless, we might no longer respect what the court has to say. I certainly don't. But it's still there. There are going to be cases tomorrow, too. And those justices are going to have to keep doing something. Social constructs are not less real for being constructs. You can point out that money has no reality apart from our belief in it, and that there is no theoretical reason why we couldn't believe in something else, but this is a practically useless discovery on its own. In fact, anarchistic questions are often frightening, because once we deconstruct various certainties, it can be unclear what to put in their place. This is actually apparently the best, if not only, kind of form, like actual coherent conservative argument, like that isn't based on bias and the fallacies that I've been discussing. That, like, once you deconstruct, like, our lies, what do you get? You know, you just go into nihilistic stupor, and we can't have that. So isn't this not worth doing any of that questioning stuff? But it's not an argument really either. One of the main anarchist slogans is no gods, no masters. But having gods and masters makes it easy to avoid the problem of having to decide what to do. The decision has already been made for you. And I'm speaking of his side here. And in these times of confusion, a strong man is what a lot of people are looking for, whether they be right-wingers who hate brown people or liberals who drink lattes. If it is not fair to have a class of capitalists or a class of laborers, then what kinds of alternative ownership structures do we need? Is it because socialists struggle with those incredibly difficult questions that they are often dismissed as impracticable dreamers? But note that the impossibility of precisely describe alternatives does not mean that a person is wrong. I A peasant objecting to feudalism need not come up with an alternative way of doing things to have a sound objection. The anarchist tradition is awfully strongly democratic. If you read old anarchist books, you will find that they are accessible because anarchists believe in democratizing knowledge and are suspicious of having a small class of intellectuals be the only ones who understand things. Anarchists are generally pro-decentralization, as I said earlier. They do not like concentrated power, and they raise important questions about how we can balance the need to accomplish things with making sure there is mass participation. Occupy's General Assemblies, with their consensus process, were an example of anarchist democracy, which is beautiful and uncommonly inclusive, but often maddeningly inefficient. Now, I have many stories about that, because I was in it. I was a participant. And it's kind of how I got my anarchist tendencies, by experiencing it firsthand, these alternatives. It was no longer just questions and lack of answers to them, but now there was an actual alternative. So the second half of this show, which is coming up, will be an exploration of those. Anarchist thinking will help you avoid error. It helped me in 2016, for instance, because I have an anarchist mindset. I wasn't satisfied with pundits' predictions that Donald Trump would fail, which seemed to conflict with things I knew about reality. And I didn't understand why Democrats thought that they could nominate a candidate under active FBI investigation without being a massive electability risk. People kept saying things were true, but you need to remain puzzled and ask whether they actually are true. People say Pete Buttigieg is a progressive. I, as an anarchist, decided to read his memoir and find out whether this was true. It turned out that it was not. I am not uniquely knowledgeable about politics, even though he's the editor of a political magazine. Many people know many more facts than I do. What I do have is an anarchistic disposition, and this helps me notice things that are frequently missed. The anarchist thinks to themselves, I wonder if that person is distorting the findings of the study. I better read the primary source to find out. Because they were disinclined to be differential, and lo and behold, the person was distorting the findings of the study. If you are not a radical skeptic, you would never have found out. But you also have to have the time to do that, you know? This same tendency led me to think the celebrated intellectual Jordan Peterson. I wonder if I read his magnum opus, Maps of Meeting, I will find that it was mostly nonsense, and it was. When you see the celebrated intellectual Steven Pinker being hailed for their reasoning, it makes me more skeptical. So I actually go through the work, collectively judge it for myself of whether Bill Gates' elusive blurbs are justified. They're usually not. And I did that on my the show previously. So last paragraph, skipping the end. It can be very satisfying to feel like the only free person on the train, the one person who sees emperors in their nudity. It can make you feel less insane and alienated from the world. But it can also make you an ass, which Socrates and Kinsky's laborer both were, and prevent you from making the compromises necessary to work with and live with other people. One has to be careful. Still, I like anarchists because I feel as if they would be the ones shouting, "Put down your weapons, you are free to choose," at the soldiers coming to drag them away. The anarchist will not tolerate even the pettiest of injustices, and therefore help prevent small ones from becoming normalized and rationalized, you know, thus becoming reasonable, and mutating into very large injustices. I would probably no longer describe my politics as anarchist, but I would say that every person should try to be one at least a few times a day. It would make everything clearer. We might all be better off. In fact, who knows what might accomplish once we see things for what they really are. And I've hit the halfway point of the show. So I'll see you on the other half, where I will talk about dual power and the practical alternatives of anarchist projects. Okay. Warning, this song has an F-bomb in it.
I don't drive a car because they run on gas. But if I did, it'd run on biomass. I ride a bike or sometimes a skateboard. So fuck off all you drivers and your yuppie hordes sitting all day in the traffic queues. I'm a better anarchist than you. I don't eat meat. I just live on moldy chives or the donuts that I found in last week's dumpster dives. Look at you people in that restaurant, I think you are so sad when you could have been eating bagels like the ones that I just had. I think it is a shame all the bourgeois things you do. I'm a better anarchist than you. I don't wear leather, and I like my clothes in black, and I made a really cool hammock from a moldy coffee sack. I like to hop on freight trains. I think that is so cool. It's so much funner doing this than being stuck in school. I can't believe you're wearing those brand new shiny shoes. I'm a better anarchist than you. I don't have sex, and there will be no sequel, because heterosexual relationships are inherently unequal. I'll just keep on moshing to anti-flag and crass until there are no differences in gender, race, or class. All you brainwashed breeders, you just haven't got a clue. I'm a better anarchist than you. I don't believe in leaders. I think consensus is the key. I don't believe in stupid notions like representative democracy. Whether or not it works, I know it is the case that only direct action can save the human race. So when I see you in your voting booth, then I know it's true. I'm a better anarchist than you. I am not a pacifist. I like throwing bricks, and when the cops have caught me and I've taken a few licks, I always feel lucky if I get a bloody nose, because I feel so militant and everybody knows. By the time the riot is all through, I'm a better anarchist than you. I'm a better anarchist than you.
All right. That was David Rorix with I'm a Better Anarchist Than You. Really like that song. Takes the piss out of you if you take it too seriously. I need to choose between either, and I just closed some of my other tabs, where like I have a step-by-step guide on doing direct action, as mentioned in the song, but it's basically like, actually, I will do that one. Not because I'm going to do the whole thing, but there's a section of it that I think is pretty useful in talking about anarchist organization, decentralized organization, how to do things in a way that isn't like a corporation, because really what makes the modern state, you know, when people start complaining about bureaucracy, it wasn't the government that started bureaucracy. Corporations started bureaucracy. They became really good at it, and then the state had to follow it because corporations were able to do big things, big organized modern things like building skyscrapers and warships and go to the moon, I guess, because of a corporate bureaucratic structure. And the government had to adapt to that and followed it. It wasn't a invention of the leftist status, fascinatingly enough. So I'll start with the direct action step-by-step guide. I'm not going to read all of it because, at least not on air, because there's morally gray areas that it touches on. In fact, I will do, I have not yet done a separate YouTube or Facebook stream where I cover articles that I don't get to during the main show here. But what I can do in the meantime is talk about, this is from Crime Think, which gives you kind of an idea that it actually does, in fact, give you step-by-step directions on maybe how to do illegal things. I find it fascinating that the Disney movie Tomorrowland, pretty much panned, not real liked. I liked the first two-thirds of it. It starts with our main character committing a felony by sabotaging bulldozers that are about to demolish this launch pad, you know, saving the future, or at least the vision of Tomorrowland, a future where we have space travel and push boundaries. But anyway, just a mainstream example of that, corrupting the youth, I guess. Direct action, simply put, means cutting out the middleman, solving problems rather yourself rather than petitioning authorities. You know, if you're questioning authority, how do you get things done, right? You're not going to go through authority anymore. Or relying on any external institutions. So let's say after the Democratic Convention, you're turned off of voting, you know, it's pointless, electoralism, no bueno. You're just going to fall in, you know, the fear is that people will just fall into nihilism and cynicism. hopefully. That's kind of why I do this show. It's that, you know, if things don't work out with Bernie Sanders, and I assume they won't, people need to know what else to do, right? It's useless just to keep questioning authority, like Robinson pointed out, without alternatives to actually offer. And so doing direct action in one's community when, say, your local government or federal government either can't or won't, and corporations, the market, also can't or won't do anything to provide the good life or any kind of sensible comfort, it falls to do this umbrella term of direct action. So, but it's usually like, say, a demonstration, a protest, an act of sabotage, to put it in the morally gray area, legalistically black. It includes everything from blockading airports, helping refugees like the Underground Railroad, things that are celebrated from our history, count as direct action, going against the law, and organizing programs to liberate your community from reliance on capitalism. But, of course, if you are anti-violence, which many are, and it's for good reason, we don't want to rely on it or even use it at all. That's true. Think of direct action also being civil disobedience. So you're breaking the law, getting arrested, but not committing any violence. Here we present a step-by-step guide to organizing and carrying out a direct action from the planning stations to the debrief at the end, maintaining proper security, getting legal support, and having a media strategy if your action is public. Because you can do things on the down low and still be pretty effective. There are countless scenarios in which you might want to employ direct action. Perhaps representatives of a despicable multinational corporation are invading your town to hold a meeting, and you want to do more than simply hold a sign. Perhaps they've been there a long time operating franchises that exploit workers and ravage the environment, and you want to hinder their misdeeds. Perhaps you want to organize a festive, community-oriented event, such as a street party. Direct action can plant a public garden in an abandoned lot, or defend it by paralyzing bulldozers. It can occupy empty buildings to house the homeless, shut down government offices. Whether you're acting in secret or with a mass action of thousands, the basic elements are the same. So it goes over the brainwashing and setting the goals, you know, very large questions of what you want to accomplish. What are your goals? What are your secondary objectives in case the first ones can't be obtained? It gives a general attitude of start really secure and paranoid. And then as you know what your plan is as it unfolds, and how many people are needed, then you become less paranoid and bring people in and start sharing information on less of a need-to-know basis. But what I really want to cover in this part, and I'll cover the rest maybe at another time in another format that isn't on there and under FCC regulations, is the structure of the Infinity Group. So this is kind of an umbrella term, but it's a term that's pretty... what was interesting was... There was a debate in a local organization that led to a split. It's one of those really short-sighted kind of things where they were arguing about whether to call what they were doing infinity groups or working groups. Sigh. One of the most efficient, but it came down to two people who couldn't like compromise or give in to, like, okay, we'll call it working groups. And the other was like, not going to say, okay, we'll call it affinity groups. Doesn't matter, but the point is affinity group, but it can also be called a working group or even something else, a committee. Calling it a committee is a type of affinity group. But a committee kind of implies a official kind of official posture to it, more formal. So one of the most efficient and secure models for any kind of organizing, direct action or otherwise, to me, is an affinity group model. It's a model, not just a noun. An affinity group is a group of friends who trust each other deeply and share the same goals. Working together over a long period of time, they become more efficient and effective. So like any kind of team. So you could call them teams too. For a small action, the members of an affinity group can take on different roles. For a larger action, an affinity group can work with other affinity groups in a cluster, for each group playing a role. This can make decision-making easier than it would in one big mass, one big group of people, as each group can send a representative to a spokes council, as it's called. Clusters of affinity groups can work together over long periods, building trust and effectiveness. So I'm going to break down that paragraph where how to think in terms of like socialist economics. Now, questions of funding and the base, what the currency is based on aside, those are different questions, but let's just talk about businesses. An affinity group can be like a business. We love small businesses. We want to promote small businesses. Let's say a business of 5 to 10 people. Because when we think of, and we should be thinking of, and I've covered this a dozen times, when it comes to decision making, democratic decision making, a consensus process or a process that actually can hear everybody out, where everybody has a say, doesn't go above 10 people. You want to keep groups, whether they're making decisions or just working together. A team doesn't go above 10 people or 8 people, but roughly 10, 8 to 12. This is the same for studios in art and architecture schools, in education studios. The ideal classroom size is roughly, 12 students. And so like a small business, that's like 10 people. And then like say, and that's an affinity group. An affinity group isn't like, it describes it as a close group of friends. But to me, since like friend groups can be, people with the same interests, same hobbies, same viewpoints, same backgrounds. But you can have other groups where those things are the same, but like they're more like associates. So maybe I'm more of a trusting individual, and this is where security culture gets more dicey with me, is I feel like we should be able to have more latent trust in people who have put in the work to be trustworthy. I know that they've done this, these, and these other projects. I know like what kind of viewpoint they have. I've listened to them in some meeting or setting or party, so I've met them a few times. I don't have to trust them completely to be an affinity group with them. But the point is that affinity group can stay small and can be your trusted, personal in-group. But then there's a threat of cliquishness, which actually this article does address at the end, which is interesting. That's why it's worth reading all of it. And I'll certainly link to it in the post of this show. But thinking in terms of not just political action, but small businesses. So let's say we have a model of economics where it's all small businesses, you're actually limited to having a business that's 10 people. Actually, that wouldn't be the case, but so no regulation like that. That's not anarchistic anyway. Point is, you divide all, and as we kind of already do, corporations and big states do this, of course. They have work groups of teams of 10 people. But instead of having groups, one work group answer to another work group or committee, and then eventually you get to the board of 10 people that governs a whole corporation, 500,000 workers, one board of 10 people. That's hierarchy. That's authoritarian. What if, as can occur, you have many affinity groups that then send one of their members as a delegate, as a rep, to make decisions to the next group of 10 up, right? So you can have a pyramid style of representation, but it's more like a wheel and hubs with groups going towards a middle, where then you have a board, but basically those 10 people each represent sections going down. So I just wanted to cover that. Now let's spend the rest of it covering the actual kind of affinity groups are good for getting a project going. Project that does not rely on any existing institution. So let's say, as you might or might in the future, not trust any of our existing institutions. Are institutions like the Democratic Party, institutions like banks, institutions like, name whatever comes to mind. And you want to make new ones because we need institutions. We need social, we need things to rely on that because just the self-reliance just isn't acceptable. It's not reasonable. And thus, and if we're going to get like, say, free full access college, we need a much bigger movement than we have now. And a lot of more people active. But people become more active addressing their immediate needs. And thus, direct action is the form that takes. Instead of saying, organizing to pressure government to fund X program. It's a lot of steps. Why not just organize to address the need? And that's the kind of, and that's what post-capitalist work does to do projects that address basic needs and sometimes not basic needs, like throwing parties, but without relying on any capitalist institution outside of fiat currency, I guess, if you're going to use money. So here's an article from The Guardian, and I'm not going to go through all of it, but I'm going to summarize and read a paragraph or two. It's the city preparing itself for the collapse of capitalism. It's kind of a bombastic title, actually. It's not so much as that, but from a festival that helps artists trade work for healthcare to a regional microcurrency, Kingston, New York, is trying to build an inclusive and self-sufficient local ecosystem. So when it comes to all these affinity groups and organizations that collaborate and cooperate with each other, that can sometimes be called an ecosystem of sorts, like a social ecosystem. This is where thinking like an ecologist comes into play. And if you just think in terms of how things interrelate with each other, you're thinking like an ecologist. That's where, you know, it's why ecology is the kind of science where it's kind of difficult to master, but everyone can pick up. Kingston, New York is a diverse city of 23,000, so it's a very small town as well, flanked to the east by a creek and the Hudson River, to the west by the Catskill Mountains. It boasts rustic industrial waterfront, a colorful historic district, Revolutionary War era stone buildings. Kingston was New York's original capital. A stranger might call it bubotic. The writer says, I moved to Kingston from New York City just over a decade ago on the heels of the recession. I was 3 years out of university, but my fledgling career in media stalled with the downturn. I can relate to that. Friends of mine, two painters, one in their 30s and one in their 40s, owned a building with an available apartment where we could afford to live and work. So thus, these down-and-out artists became an affinity group because they have a lot in common. And from that affinity group, they started a project. This person and their neighbors treated me like a family, thus trust. Our community was diverse in age, but we all had independent creative pursuits in a place with scant economic opportunity otherwise. Thus, many of us share the same problem, a lack of access to health care. America's healthcare system has long been in shambles. Don't think I need to go into that, do I? But I am always surprised by those who do need to explain to them how inaccessible healthcare actually is, at least especially when it comes to good and the kind of healthcare that one desires. So we came up with a plan. Drawing on an age-old barter system, we figured out a way to trade the art of medicine for the art for the medicine of art. So in October 2010, the year before Occupy, so this shows like how long it takes to really develop these projects. It takes like a 10-year cycle of sorts. We launched our first weekend-long festival, street art, live music, and health-related events. We called it O Positive, like the blood type. The general public attended by donation. Licensed health professionals volunteer to staff an on-site pop-up clinic. Over the years, thousands of participating artists, like the B-52s, David Bowie even, have received medical, dental, and wellness services worth hundreds of dollars, in some cases thousands. Some artists say that the care they received has saved them. So it's a barter between artists and musicians that participate in this festival, and in return, a volunteer medical staff then provide healthcare services to them. So it's a barter, service for service, and the public benefits from both. Plug in for time banking again. Time banking is much more, this is like a one-time festival thing because it is such a like a valued commodity, the healthcare. Its organizers have constantly expanded to connect the general public to more resources. Narcan kits would basically help save someone from overdosing. CPR training, health expos, year-round wellness classes. Local publicos and residents who take issue with the public art that earns participants dental work and medical appointments have thrown up various roadblocks. But the cause has always been fueled by a sense of rebellion, with the understanding that artists need health care and that art has health benefits. Now, why would there be objections to this? Kind of enforce the monopoly view of health care is for the deserving. These things are not of equivalent value in the marketplace, so how could you trade them? So on. The way you change the system nationally is you do the thousand little local things, and eventually the system evolves, says O Positive Executive Director Joe Concura. So meaning they have nonprofit status. whose building I lived in when I first got this festival off the ground and who volunteered full-time for years until grants and donors made it possible to pay a modest salary to 3 full-time and 7 part-time employees. There you go, 10 people. Every time I walk into the clinic, I think, oh yeah, it is possible to build a new system. I refuse to believe we can't, so we keep doing it. And having nonprofit status means you're like you're basically licensed by the state to do a public good, to do something that isn't market or state-based, and you're not taxed for it, or there's limited taxing. So it's a way of like operating as an institution without being completely dependent on existing institutions. There's still kind of a soft area where we can say, ugh, you're still selling out if you're being a nonprofit. O positive may have brought the carnival. Now it's far alone in the revolution, or in being one. Kingston's anti-capitalist, anti-establishment healthcare network is just one example of a model that could supplant corporate America. Locals have launched a non-commercial radio station, like the one I'm operating out of right now. Radio Kingston, WKNY, has widely representative hyper-local programming that broadcasts via power generators if the grid goes dark. A regional microcurrency called the Hudson Valley Current now exists. According to co-founder David McCarthy, create an ecosystem that includes everyone. Because some people, like if you have really bad credit, you can't even get a bank account. Agricultural initiatives like Farm Hub work towards equitable, resilient food systems, because you need food. A network of bike trails quietly connects local towns to local farms for the day when there is no more gas in our cars. And organizations like Rise Up Kingston, Kingston Citizens, Nobody Leaves Mid-Hudson, and the Kingston Tenants Union facilitate civic engagement, combat displacement, so fight gentrification and stuff, and advocate for policies to address an increasingly dire housing shortage. From my vantage in the Deep South, it looks as though, and this is the writer, one mission at a time, Kingston is piecing together the infrastructure for a self-sufficient community, one that wants to survive the possibility impending systematic collapse we nervously joke about over beers at a local bar. DuPont at Half Moon doesn't believe the average Kingstonite is actively battering down the hatches for a societal implosion, but, she says, I do think the economic pressures, especially skyrocketing housing costs, are causing people to look at new ways to network and support each other. Meanwhile, directors of the above organizations and others are facing questions like, how can we make sure we have all the resources we need? And how do we not leave anyone behind? Now, I want to like back up and say, like, yeah, these aren't really anarchistic projects, not only because they're nonprofits and have this legal status, but because they have a director and employees. They are operating like a business, but a small 10-person business, nonprofit or otherwise, is still can be more democratic. And I assume, these being lefty who talk of revolutionary potential or just not being capitalist, being anti-capitalist itself is, you know, very out there. Wanted to be more normal, democratic decision-making in their nonprofit. But they have a director, there's a title for the person who's in charge. I think I've talked about this already. But we have underliners, someone who is responsible for getting the task done in any working group. And so you can have some kind of temporary leadership, and everybody kind of rotates who's underliner, always, you know, whoever's underliner is, you know, by expected to train their replacement, which many hierarchies don't. Or if they are, then it's a career, and it's a structure of compliance. The first weekend in November at the local elementary school, the public was welcomed at a conference called Surviving the Future: Connection and Community in Unstable Times. So the last section of this article is to talk about the conference that was in Kingston, which was kind of about bringing a lot of these projects together, or at least to talk to each other, as they likely do, but to actually see themselves as a whole. Imagining it from the ground up is a big part of the work at hand. On a panel about housing as a human right, co-hosted by Radio Kingston, O Positive, and the Hudson Valley LGBTQ Community Center, and others, Kelly Jane of Rise Up Kingston says of working models to address her primary concern, the housing crisis. Quote, If it hasn't been done before, that's probably a good thing because what we're doing now is not working. I'm privileged to be part of the high-level conversations about what happens next, says Radio Kingston Executive Director Jimmy Buff. Other people here have just trying to find a place that doesn't take half of their income, trying to stay in the places they've lived for decades, and not being gentrified out of their neighborhoods. The climate crisis, potential civil unrest. How do we unify locally to provide ourselves when all the things that seem to be going south do indeed go south? I wonder about this constantly, but in Savannah, where I guess this writer lives, a racially divided, politically divided city of 125,000, with a poverty rate of a quarter higher than Kingston's, I'm in a very quiet minority. There is no AM frequency of ongoing conversations of equity via the diverse voices of my neighbors. I haven't seen apocalyptic lit in the bookshop windows. When I think about how unprepared we are for a meltdown, I miss Kingston most of all. When the crap hits the fan, no one's coming to rescue us, Buff says. We've got to figure it out for ourselves because this is our city. This is where we live. This is what we've got. Oh yeah. And something that I guess wasn't mentioned in the Kingston one, I think it was, here's the thing. A lot of these nonprofits, again, it mentions grants and other things. So like, where does this money come from, right? Well, it comes from people who has the most money. Capitalists. Or the inheritors of capitalism, which is the case where Jimmy Buffett, the kind of more radical son of Warren Buffett, the Wall Street mogul, he likes giving to post-capitalist projects. So he is kind of bankrolling a lot of these nonprofits that now have employees that actually pay themselves salaries. There's a book that I probably need to read. It's called The Revolution Won't Be Funded. Now, I don't know if that means like it needs to be crowdfunded or I think that's what it means because like it, funding of nonprofits and projects, community projects, is through grants, whether they be federal or corporate grants or foundations, which are basically funded by rich people. And whether it be, like I said, a co-op that's worker-owned and managed but still funded by a capitalist enterprise, it's going to be influenced by how it came into being, who is funding it. Now, where something becomes actually socialist or proto-socialist, whatever, actually community-owned and funded. But otherwise, if you have, you know, a poor neighborhood or a middle-class neighborhood, and everybody in it or a lot of people in it pitch in $100, you know, you get, let's say, 50, 100 grand together, you can buy a property or a business and then get a return on it, which means, you know, enterprises and nonprofits or these community loan funds, they still have to act like capitalists, but they're doing it for community benefit. They're doing it more democratically. So it's better, but it's still capitalist because they're still working under capitalist rules. So to be post-capitalist is to eventually, like the goals of these organizations, which is kind of difficult, but to be at a place where they don't need the grants anymore. They don't need a rich person funding them. And that's like the unanswered question for me as to how to do that. Whether there is an answer, but like how often does it succeed? Which is the answer is you crowdfund. But not just crowdfund once, as has been shown is amazingly successful, that there's many different crowdfunding sites that people can fund themselves through mutual aid via crowdfunding, because you just cast a wider net, though, of basically the entire world or the entire country. And that in itself is kind of a problem to me, because then it's not local and community-based really anymore, unless the community is something that is national and international. Which brings up more questions than commentary for me. But generally, there's the due-paying system of membership that people who actively use an institution like this post-capitalist institution are paying a membership. But then, of course, it becomes a circular argument of where do people get the income to pay such memberships? They must earn an income on the market via capitalist enterprises or the government. And then it becomes one big, oh, there you go again. it never ends. How do you escape capitalism? How do you fund something to the point where you don't need to be funded anymore? And that's where it becomes kind of this independent, the interdependence of groups, where like everyone's membership is no longer in dollars, but in the hours and the labor they put in at all of the, say, institutions slash businesses they put in. And having alternative currency can help facilitate that transition, whether it be, you know, time, you know, like hours, literal time, or like that kind of Hudson Valley current, because it's the river, you know, river valley, call it the current. Clever. So, okay, here's something a little lighter and short, but related to the Kingston piece. From Vice is, if you hate capitalism, because if you hate Mondays, you hate capitalism. And if you're depressed, it's not life, it's capitalism. You'll love this map. The Black Socialists of America are hoping to put alternatives to capitalism on the map with their newest project. Filed by Edward Ogusso Jr. So the Black Socialists of America, BSA, if you didn't know they existed, they do. A coalition of anti-capitalist internationalist Black Americans just launched its dual power map. I didn't clarify what dual power was, did I? Dual power is literally just the term for everything I've been talking about. This ecosystem of non-capitalist enterprises. Things that are, if not completely distethered, because it's really hard and difficult, if not impossible, to be untethered from our system, but seek to be untethered as much as possible. They seek to be alternative institutions to the ones that are failing us. Even the traditional unions count as this. So more radical, militant, alternative unions need to be formed as well. And so like new tenants unions count as that. And that all is under the umbrella of dual power. Why? Because the eventual accepted goal or the eventuality is that all of these institutions, as they band together, collaborate more, they become a shadow government, like a second society that is within the market economy, but it's no longer dependent on it anymore. And if there's anything people in power despise, it's anyone who isn't under their boot. And so there will be conflict or some kind of confrontation. It could be resolved peacefully in terms of like, but it will not be bygones be bygones. It will be some kind of fight of some kind. And thus it's called dual power, to have a power that is not in the hands of the corporations, the state, the politicians, the insert people you hate here. To have a separate power, dual power. So the map promises to plot every single worker co-op, small business development center, community land trust, dual power project in America. So, quote, you can support them right now, because we need to be connected to such things. Otherwise, one could be around the corner and you don't even know it. But what are any of these things? What is dual power? Why should you care? Oh, there I go again. I describe something that the article's got to do, but you know, let's use this person's words. Because he does use different ones. At its heart, dual power is a socialist strategy concerned with helping people who are unable to have their needs met by capitalism, as many aren't. The strategy calls for a counter institution or institutions that not only meet the needs of those left behind, but are run by those very people. You know, peer support is superior to traditional therapy. It also calls for people to protect and develop these institutions into forms of social, economic, and political counterpower by forming social movements around them. So they're like one and the same. The institutions support the social movement supports the enterprises. Simply put, counter-institutions try to help realize a just world, while counterpower aims to fight against an unjust one. Worker co-ops are typically businesses that are owned and self-managed instead of bosses and CEOs and having a different kind of stockholder. Small business development centers are essentially spaces for businesses to receive advice and support that will help them thrive in a specific locale. Community land trusts are local nonprofits that permanently maintain ownership of land for the good of community, and thus then they lease the house that's on them, such as buildings and affordable housing. No more property tax. All of these counter institutions, but none are explicitly anti-capitalist. They may be better equipped to meet the needs of people who want dignified work, safer working conditions, and more affordable housing, but these are also things that some self-professed capitalists like Yang and Elizabeth Warren are currently calling for. Yes, so they count as progressive. The crux is whether or not the counter-institutions are utilized in a way that challenges capitalism while supporting the non-capitalist alternatives. Enter Cooperation Jackson, a socialist cooperative in Jackson, Mississippi, that seeks to develop an alternative economy that is explicitly anti-capitalist. I've mentioned them in the past, but let's go into actually what they are. The cooperative's ambition is to build a project based on a network of counter-institutions concerning those, you know, groups and affinity groups that are concerned with, quoting them, organizing and empowering the structurally under and unemployed sectors of the working class, particularly in Black and Latino communities. This can also be called the underclass. People who are, by market standards, deemed as unemployable. Cooperation Jackson wants to create a new economy as the basis of a new society that can sustain itself without relying on the politics that dominate the world around them. This organization aims to use community trust to decommodify as much land as possible by making housing a guaranteed right instead of something you rent or buy on a marketplace. It wants to create an alternative manufacturing base that responds to the needs of community as opposed to the needs of a market, valuing sustainability over waste and endless growth. So how do we address all these issues I've been bringing up in the past several weeks, few weeks? Ourselves, if we're not going to pass regulations that say require compostability of everything you buy in a store, you make your own store and your own factory to make household goods that are compostable. But that's a lot of steps and a lot of work and a lot of how do we fund our new laundry service? How do we fund the businesses that we have around us that are more than just one person starting a business and saying we need more small businesses, we need more Black or minority or just small, like just local owners, right? But this is accepting the framework of capitalism. And then the question is, why don't we have all these new local businesses? Why can't I just start a business if I see a need? It needs to be funded. You need to prove that you can be funded, that you will have a return on investment to the bank or the stockholders. This is very difficult. And it encourages, incentivizes exploitation, breaking rules about dumping pollution and whatnot. You got to make it work, the numbers, no matter what. And that means usually not doing good by the community. Now, Z, one of Black Socialists of America's co-founders, explained how the purpose of this map that they've created is to help inform people of counter-institutions so they can help to develop their own local efforts and make their own dual-power projects. Quoting them, most left orgs are focused on electoral politics or reactive activism or even mutual aid. All those things are important, but if we want to dismantle capitalism, you know, system change, then we have to build institutions and we have to deal with the economy. Co-ops might be a great place to work and your local community land trust might be a good place give a good price for rent, but at the end of the day, they are still institutions that have to be utilized a certain way to build anti-capitalist alternatives like Cooperation Jackson. And not say they're not ends in themselves, because otherwise they're just kind of helping people cope with the system as it is. On their website, the BSA points out that the goal is to infuse these alternatives with a political ideology that will lead us to a fully democratic society, a world where workers themselves control the means of production in a democratic and decentralized fashion. That means the map should serve as a tool for activists who hate capitalism and want to see their community's needs met, but aren't sure how it all fits together. To that end, building dual power is a great place to start. Quoting again, and final, if we are talking about revolution, and more of us should be, we have to be about revolutionary system change. We can't just do things within the limits of the capitalist framework. We have to build to transcend it. And that's something, regardless of revolution rhetoric with Bernie Sanders, he's not transcending the Democratic Party. It just isn't. And thus, when the superdelegates are in play and then we get to the convention, the institutions will be there to work against whatever popular movement that is built. Because it didn't transcend the party. It's not free of it. Now, I hope, like, it could be, and I'm not seeing it, these organizations, well, a lot of the groups helping Bernie Sanders, let's say DSA, can operate outside of electoral politics if they so choose, and many do. Cooperation Jackson actually did electoral politics. I did it in a year ago. They make the case like, we actually tried, we elected our own local people. We actually like took over Jackson government pretty much. But then we were basically stopped by the state government from doing basically our socialism. Like, we were literally stopped. Then we were primaried, and or we had opponents that were establishment Dems, and they took everything back from us. And it just it took a lot of resources to hold on to the usual institutions of power, because we were fighting those who hold it. And so thus, it is more effective in the long term, okay, not short term, long term, to build our own. And this is a project, this is something that takes 10 years, you know. This radio station is kind of a husk at the moment. We need more help. We need more volunteers. And eventually, once things are set up and such, to have member support, to use your capitalist currency to support this project and thus have a community-owned media station. I mean, we already own it, but we need operating money. And we need money to kind of do more parties and events and become the institution that is truly a counter to the corporate radio stations, but to be a counter to all of that trash. Oh, yeah. I'll finish with one more minute. I want to promote my hashtag. It's my slogan I'm going to have this year, at least this year. I call it Uncancel the Left. Mainstream culture kind of media talks of the left being, you know, cancel culture, obsessed with canceling people. This is completely backwards. When the left wants to cancel someone or deplatform or whatever, it's really just the refusal to be canceled again, us being canceled. Because, you see, American history, going back to the 50s and 60s, before the 50s, there was a robust left in America. There were militant unions. There were socialist parties, a lot of stuff. And it really seemed like they were building a dual power themselves as well. You had capitalist businesses owned by communist party members, and they basically gave all the profits they made to the party. So they're well funded. How did they lose all of this funding? Well, blacklisting. You know, these enterprises were called out, called unpatriotic, these owners, and thus people stopped doing business with them. Blacklisting, as far as mainstream culture, people know of actors being blacklisted in the McCarthy era. But it wasn't just actors. Oh, no, it wasn't just actors. It was teachers, anyone in government employment, anyone in a public sector or a cultural institution. Everyone had to disassociate with the left. An actual independent militant left. The left was canceled in the real economically pressured way. If you were a left winger, you were suddenly made a pariah. The response by student movements was to then become much less militant, more electorally focused. And then by the 70s, anyone who was kind of the left had to basically be on the down low. Actions had to take on an entirely pacifist and civil disobedient kind of direction, not only because by then it looked like that was what worked, but there were many internal debates as well. But the left needed to be less armed. The criminalization of being a left winger, of building dual power, we can't let that happen again. And that means internalizing the view that we will not let ourselves be canceled, that we will push back hard. Do whatever it takes, whatever that means, to not be canceled, to not allow those to be blacklisted, and to dissuade our friends and family from buying any propaganda about how if you're a lefty, if you want system change, you're a foreign agent, you're with the enemies out there, the enemies, the terrorists. They are economic terrorism. You see it on Fox News, and pretty soon you'll see the liberal networks using the same language. Don't believe me, they're already doing it. Russiagate was all about using jingoism and nationalism to basically say that Bernie Sanders and the Sanderistas, these Bernie bros, all this language, it's all to say the same thing that McCarthy era did, which is to say that if you aren't a moderate, practical for the status quo, you are unpatriotic, un-American, an enemy. We can't let that happen again, though it kind of is. Well, at the moment, it's basically designed to keep the left canceled. The left has not been uncanceled because when we'll know we're uncanceled when this propaganda seeks being effective, when nobody parrots and then all laugh at the moderate position of like that headline that's basically the complete lie that Sanders is receiving help from Russian agents that are biased and they want chaos in America. Take it as the lying propaganda that it is, the biased media reporting of real, if not sort of real facts or realities, but taken and twisted to keep the left canceled. So I say, uncancel the left. I demand it because I refuse to be shut up in a hole anymore. Not only personally, but looking back at the generations, the past generations who have been suppressed. So anyway, this is the Three Left Show. Let's wrap it up. Three Left Show is on Facebook and Twitter. That is our social media. Share and like and do all the things to help promote the show. It really does. I don't need more listeners, but I would like to have more listeners. And if you think if anyone would like this show, I believe this kind of, you know, leftist commentary is unique to our area. And as one listener actually said to me, and so shout out to him, and I'd like that to continue. Support me materially, and particularly the station, by donating to the Patreon page I have, Three Left Show. The website, threelefts.news, has a full archive of episodes. And descriptions and links to articles used in each episode, more or less. And that is it. And I'm just going to do a hard close. So have a good one. Stay frosty and uncancel the left. Toodles.